I'm Karen Barta from Seattle University, and I'm pleased to be here. And this first session I have named, I have different names for the sessions and the ones that are in the program there. So this one I've called, in the beginning was the text, naturally. So I would like to devote this first session to talking about the biblical text. And I'd like to begin with a quotation I found in Mae Sarton's journals, one of her journals. And she is a saying that she had gotten from W.H. Auden to the effect that we moderns are fast losing two precious qualities, the ability to laugh heartily and the ability to pray. So often on my teaching, I tell my class I'd like to start with a joke and with a prayer. So we just had a lovely prayer service. So I'd like to tell you a joke, and since I'm Roman Catholic, I thought I would tell some Roman Catholic jokes here. And one of them is a friend of mine tells about this little town down in Texas, on the Texas coast, that was very Irish and very Catholic. In fact, the town was called McMurphy. They were so Irish that they painted their fire engine green. And one day, there was an alarm that went off at an oil rig that caught on fire. And McMurphy was one of the little hamlets nearby, so it got ready to go off. And of course, a number of other fire engines that were closer got there first. In fact, they got there and they formed kind of a semicircle around the edge there where the rig was burning, and the flames were so high that they really had just stopped at a distance. But when McMurphy came, this little green engine went all the way down, and there was a little opening and went right to the edge, and they jumped out and they put up the hoses, and they were able to get the fire down enough that the other engines came in and they put out the blaze. And the owner of the rig was so delighted that he had a special banquet for all of those who had answered this alarm. And particularly, he wanted to thank the crew that came from McMurphy. And so at the end of the meal, he called up the fire chief. And it was just a small town. So he presented him with a check for $10,000. And he said, I know that's a good bit of money for a little town like McMurphy. So he said, I'd like to ask the chief if he could give us an idea of how they might use this money. And the chief paused and he said, well, he said, I know one of the first things we're going to do is have the brakes on that engine checked. A number of you told me at the little get-together earlier that you liked the Gospel of John, and that's a favorite of mine too, because I think it's profoundly divine and it's profoundly human. And it begins with that wonderful line, "In the beginning was the Word." So as Christians, it seems to me, we take language very seriously. Language is sacred. It's important. It has power. When I was growing up, I'm sure like you, you heard the saying as kids, we used to say, sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me. Do you remember that?
It was a lie.
But the fact is that words hurt. And they maim, and they can kill. But words can really lift up, too. Words can make you feel good. Words are really important. So I'd like to begin there, with the importance of words and of language. Fame Perkins, in a book on resurrection, a very fine book, talks about the situation we live in the 20th century. She says, We live out of a three-way conflict between the facticity of our everyday language, the conceptual language of the metaphysical traditions that gave shape to most Christian systemization of belief, and the language of metaphoric consciousness in which the Bible operates. So that the biblical text really is sedimented, if you will, in three layers, or beneath three layers. There's our everyday language, English, we use every day, which has become pretty much a one-dimensional language. One of the ways I explain that to my students is to say that in the ancient world, they lived and they could talk about and had language to talk about three worlds, actually. The world above, their world, and the world below. And that gave them more dimensions to talk about their own reality and their own experience. But we have pretty much collapsed those three mythical worlds into one, this world. And so the problem is that we don't have the language anymore to talk about the sacred. Even though people continue to have experiences of the sacred, there isn't the language to really talk about that. Some of you might be acquainted with a book by Marcus Borg, Jesus, A New Vision. I recommend that book. It's just a really fine book. And he makes much the same claim when he talks about the spiritual world of Jesus, that the spirit world was really alive. That's what they experienced, and they talked about that. But we've lost that sense again. In one sense, you could say it has a lot to do with science, that a word means one thing and only one thing. It's a way of controlling expression and language and reality. So there's a facticity of our everyday language, and remember that that's what our scriptures are translated in. When we get a new translation, an English translation, it's the language that we hear is the language of everyday English. Then, of course, there's a second level there, if you will, of how all those concepts got developed through the metaphysical traditions in the second and third centuries, so that the biblical language got really put through that lens, if you will. And that's come down to us. And then there's that third level, really the level of metaphorical or mythological language. And it's simply true that we've lost a sense of myth. When I was doing my studies some 20 years ago, as a Roman Catholic, of course, Bernard Lonergan was a great theologian for us, really important, particularly on method. I remember clearly that in my studies of Lonergan, the word myth was used in a negative sense. When he talked about the positive side of myth, he used the word mystery. That'd be, say, a mystery. But myth, of course, was used in a negative sense. So we come out of that. Many of us have a very negative understanding of myth. But the Bible is really the Bible itself is written in the mythological world, not in the kind of facticity of our language. That is to say that the text would have meant always many things to them, not just one thing. It wasn't said that one-on-one. So I've been collecting little stories about myth to give us a sense of what that is, to give our students a sense of that. And one of my favorites is actually from Joseph Campbell. This was an article in the newspaper which he was reported as saying that he had had an interview during a radio program. He said, "I walk into the studio, the red light tell you you're on isn't on yet, and here is a smart-looking young guy sitting there. I learned later he had a reputation for leaving his interviewees all over the floor. Now he says to me, I'm tough. I put it right to you. I've studied law. So Joseph Campbell goes on. He says, the red light goes on, and I say, well, I'm game. Let's go. And we're on the air. Curious thing to devote your life to myth. The man says, myth is a lie. Joseph Campbell says, no, myth isn't a lie. I had been asked that what myth was so frequently that I had a definition. I say, no, myth is metaphorical. Mythology is an organization of symbolic images and narratives that are metaphoric of the possibilities of human experience and fulfillment in a given society at a given time. Ah, he says, it's a lie. We went on in this nonsense way until about 5 minutes before the end of the half-hour program. Then I realized this guy doesn't know what a metaphor is. So I say, I tell you it's a metaphor. Give me an example of a metaphor. He disintegrates entirely. Like a kid, he says, let's get in touch with a school teacher out there. And I say, no, you tell me. We had about 2 minutes to go, and he says, so-and-so runs very fast. People say he runs like a deer. I say, that's not a metaphor. The metaphor is, so-and-so is a deer. He says, that's a lie. Joseph Campbell says, that's a metaphor. There's also another wonderful passage in the Deptford trilogies, if you're acquainted with those, a set of three novels by Robertson Davies. Really recommend I've read some of his other books, but these three are just wonderful. And the narrator in the first of the series there talks about, it's a narrator talking about when he was a small boy, say about 8 years old. And he tells how, as an 8 year old on Sundays, he and his father would go for long walks, and once in a while, Sam, the electrician, would join them on these walks. And the electrician would go to services only so that he could come out and make fun of the ministers and refute everything they said, particularly in the Bible. And this one Sunday, he had gone to church, and he said, boy, he said, I heard the minister say, oh, that a burning coal would come down and touch my lips. You know, the text from Isaiah. And then the electrician laughed heartily and said, wouldn't he be surprised, you know, the pastor, if that happened? And they laughed. But the voice of the little boy said, if he thought he was going to make an atheist out of me, he was wrong. Because I knew what a metaphor was when I heard one. And then he goes on to say, atheists fall down on metaphor. That's where they fall down. But as I say that to you, my students often enough are surprised when I say to them that all language about God is metaphorical. Somewhere along the line, they didn't get that piece. That when we say we call God Father, that's a metaphor. When we say God is one, that's a metaphor. And so as Christians, it seems to me, we have a real obligation to love language, to respect language, and to have a sense of the nature of language. When my students, for instance, when I say God is not male, well, they thought that's what they heard. And I said, well, I mean, think about it, you know? But they again think that that was, I mean, maybe it wasn't said that way, but in their ears, it was the language of facticity that really stayed with him. So I think anything we can do to really begin to work out an understanding of metaphor and myth, and realize that all of the language in the Bible comes out of that world, that understanding, that three-level world, if you will. There are some wonderful sayings there. Recently, I think of Heidegger had this wonderful saying, language is our home. It's a wonderful saying. It's another one that says, those who tell the stories rule the world. Again, on the importance of language. The poet Murriet Rukeyser said, the universe is made of stories, not of atoms. Or just for us to remember that all meaning is constructed meaning. All meaning is constructed. You have the experience, but the interpretation is something else. The meaning that you give to that experience. Another piece of this for me has come together in a workshop I did a couple years ago with Michael Mead and Robert Bly. Michael Mead is a mythologist who lives in the Seattle area. And he identifies three ways of perceiving or thinking. The concrete, the psychological, and the mythological. And he describes the concrete way of perceiving as someone who looks at things, measured them one facet at a time. That we're impressed by things, pressing against our awareness. He talks about the tension in concrete thinking as being minimal because you only consider one thing at a time. The weight or the height. The rhythms in concrete thinking are simple, like a clock, kind of strict measurement. He argues that what happens when one persists in concrete thinking is that you end up with one view or with one emotion. It's a way of perceiving that is identified by a lack of humor. And the tendency is for that kind of thinking to get heavier, more solid, like concrete, which he identifies or he defines as a cohesion of a mass that forms a solid and then gets stuck. Concrete thinking is the identity of one position only. For instance, the example he gave is of a case of abuse where you look at, say, only the victim or only the abuser. But he said the emotion identified with judgment or the emotion identified with concrete thinking is blame. Blame is singular. You usually lay it on someone. In concrete thinking, things become absolute and fundamental, usually literal following that. They're either good or bad. Eventually, often enough, it's all or nothing. I thought of the Sunday paper, if you saw the Sunday paper of Kelvin, where the pictures show black and white all the way through. And then his father at the end, I mean, it's like that's what he's seen. And then the last picture, his father is saying, well, the problem with you, Calvin, is that you're only looking at things in terms of black and white. And then he's screaming, sometimes that's the way they are. The thing about concrete thinking is that those generally people say, well, that's how they are, or that's as things are. That there's no imagination involved, and there's no comparison made. He suggests that teenagers, for instance, are experimenting with concrete thinking. The first, when you're born, that's really the thinking that you have first, because you're looking for your mother's nipple, and you have one thing in mind, you know, and you're trying to deal with reality in terms of really one need, if you will. It's only when the young infant is able to have a picture in their imagination of the mother that the mother can leave without the baby crying. So you can see the importance of imagination entering in. So it gives you an idea of concrete thinking. Psychological thinking is when one moves from the one to the two, when the perception is of self and others, not one of the other, but the self and others, or the outside and the inside, now and before, or now and the future. Psychological thinking involves bringing together two things that were apart, or separating two things that were together. So in the example earlier, you would look at not just the victim, but also the abuser. You'd look at both of those. In order to think psychologically, you need an inner image. The organ of the concrete world, you could say, is the eye. It's out there. For the psychological thinking, it's the ear. It's something also coming in. So psychological thinking requires two conversations, and dialogues would be psychological thinking. There would be insights and expressions. There would be something active and passive. It would be one or the other. There would be depth and extension, past and future. But of course, the tension then is increased in this kind of perceiving or thinking. It doubles attention, you could say. There's an awareness of more than one thing, the self and the other. Need moves to want. Instinct is moderated by memory. So that would be psychological thinking. Now, mythological thinking would be the way of the three, if you will. If the concrete is identification, and the psychological is going back and forth, simile would be an example, or compare and contrast, then the mythological would be moving into three ways. That would be the metaphorical. So it's identification on a completely different level. Instead of having, say, past and present, or present and future, you would have all of those at the same time. Within a myth, everything is present. Past and future and present. He gives a quotation from Hillman to the effect that mythological perceiving, or myth, is the most open, the most exploratory, the most suggestively subtle, yes, precise stories, which allow the soul the widest imagination for its complexes. So myth gives you a feel for multiplicity. The images and symbols for each person viewing it. There's no right and wrong involved. Proof is never the goal of myth, and myths do not explain. Myths narrate things. They're both active and passive, and we need, he says, to develop an ear for myth. an example, I guess, for a myth or an image would be, say, a cut stone that has many facets to it, so that one person can hear that myth and react and identify with one side or image or idea or emotion in that, and someone else can come at it in a different way and get something else out of it. So it's that sense of the complexity of myth, which is really nice. Now, it seems to me that consequences for modern Bible readers, for ourselves, would be then to recognize that we've lost a sense of myth, that the language of our everyday American English is concrete language because it's been reduced to one dimension. An example, again, of how this operates, I think, would be if we bring up issues of gender. Conceived concretely, you simply blame one or the other. Blame men or you blame women, one or the other. Psychological would be understanding, beginning to understand relationships between the genders. And the blame, in one sense, is not perhaps so much blame, but beginning to understand the fault, if you will, on both sides. But mythological ways of dealing with gender would have no blame at all. One of the things that happens, or again, another way to look at this is, concrete thinking sees only the light. Psychological thinking realizes that every light has a shadow. And mythological thinking, it seems to me, would have not only the light and the shadow, but many areas of gray, many kind of tones that would come into that. I think you see where I'm leading here, that a fundamentalist reading of the scriptures is perhaps our experience, what most of us have seen as concrete thinking in our own time. So one of the things I want to do is give you an example from myself of what I think would be a way to take a biblical text and to give a concrete interpretation of it, and then give a psychological interpretation and a mythological interpretation. And I've done this with a colleague of mine, and he did the text from Genesis 1, which is quite interesting. He's an Old Testament scholar. But the one I looked at, of course, was the naming of God as Father. A lot of material about this, but I think one concrete interpretation of the title of God as Father would be to say that, in fact, that's the only title for God that is admissible, or even saying it is the best title for God, that no other title is as good as that title. I think that would be a concrete way of dealing with that title for God. The second, I think, a psychological, or the way of the two, would be to see that the naming of God as Father must always be interpreted in terms of God as Son. In other words, it's a relational title. So that it's Jesus as Son, which is primary, and God as Father comes out of that. So it has to do then with trying to say that Jesus is Son, or Jesus' relationship to God as one of Son to Father. So that when you see Jesus, you see who God is. Now there's a way in which you could get that message across without using the language of Son and Father, actually, which is somewhat troubled language in many ways. Now it seems to me when you take the title of God as Father and you see that it's metaphorical, then it opens up and it invites exploration and probing. Particularly, it seems to me, within the biblical texts themselves. To give you an example, in the Gospel of Mark, there are only three times that God is addressed as Father or named Father in that entire Gospel. This Gospel of like 666 verses, and four verses use the title of God, our Father, for God. Is that often? And each one is different. Now, also what's interesting is that the first time that in the opening scene of the baptism of Jesus is when we hear the voice that says, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." So that's certainly a text that has the background of God as Father. It's interesting that what happens is that's the beginning, if you will, of Jesus' ministry, that baptism. But if you continue reading that gospel, you know where that gospel is going to go. So the time when Jesus calls God Father, it's the only time in which Jesus calls God Father, is when he's in the Garden of Gethsemane. And he's struggling with whether he wants to go through with this. And in fact prays that the chalice would pass from him. It's then, in that moment of intense agony and wondering and prayer, knowing what he's facing, that he calls God Father. Not, it seems to me, for power, for control over God, but just the opposite, as opening up himself to the kind of pain that he knows he's in for. So it's not a power to. I think oftentimes we use God as Father as a way of controlling. But in this case, it's an opening up. And it's not something that, again, Jesus instructs others to do. It's something that he does, that he takes upon himself, if you will. It's very much in that context, I think that's really important. There's another text in the Gospel of Matthew, I think, that I'm sure you've heard, but we have conveniently forgotten throughout traditions, and particularly, say, within the Roman Catholic tradition, where the text is called, "No one on earth, Father, you have one Father who is in heaven." Mm-hmm. It's a really strong critique, it seems to me, of a concrete interpretation of the title of God as Father. I'm going to pause for a moment and see if there's any question or comment any of you might have. Because I have a little project, a little activity I want you to do here. So, anyone have any suggestions or ideas? Or has it been clear so far? Okay, now, what I'd like, anyone, I shouldn't move on here, give you time to think. Well, here's what I'd like you to do in the group here. I'd like you to form a group of about three each. And I'd like you to take the story of the first feeding in the Gospel of Mark. We could have, perhaps, one person read. Joseph, would you read that for us?
Baptism?
It's in chapter 6, verse 34-44. Okay. So this is the first reading account, the first feeding account in the Gospel of Mark. Okay.
"As he went ashore, he saw a great throng, and he had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, 'This is a lonely place, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the country and the villages around about and buy themselves something to eat. But he answered them, you give them something to eat. And they said to him, shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat? And he said to them, how many loaves have you? Go and see. And when they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then he commanded them all to sit down by companies upon the green grass. So they sat down in the groups by hundreds and by fifties. And taking the 5 loaves and 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men.
Okay, now what I want you to do, that's the story. That's biblical story. Now what I want you to do is I want you to come up with a concrete interpretation of that and a psychological interpretation. And then a mythological. That is to say, I want you to come up with interpretations where it can mean only one thing, or where in fact you involve 2 things to explain what the story means, or 3 or more things. Now, you might, as an example, remember it'd be the insistence that something in there means this and only that. And that would be kind of the characteristic of a concrete thinking. Or a concrete interpretation. All right. Do you know what I'm getting at? Mm-hmm. All right. Good. All right. Now, I'm not going to give too much time, maybe 10 minutes to kind of come up with that in your group, and then we'll share those and we'll talk about what those are in just 5 minutes. This is an example of eating. Maybe we could just get examples of people came up with as a concrete interpretation of this feeding. And sometimes it's just a phrase, you know, that identifies concrete perceiving. So, anyone want to volunteer some 5,000 men? Okay. Alright. Thanks, sir. So, you'd focus on 5,000 men, is that what you mean? Yeah. Literally, these were men.
Party.
Okay. So you would really push then that was a fact, if you will.
It wasn't
that was exactly how many. What?
It says 5,000.
Karen.
Yes, the women didn't get to eat. Well, you know what's interesting? One of the things that's fun to do when you work at text, of course, is if you accept Mark, which most scholars do, as the earliest gospel, then we turn to Matthew. It's interesting that both Matthew and Luke tend to tidy up Mark's text. And so then it's Matthew who says 5,000 men, not counting the women and children. The men is probably, again, within the Mark and text. Now, whether Mark really meant that there were only men there, Matthew certainly didn't interpret the text that way. That would be really interesting. Okay. What would be some other kind of concrete interpretations of that?
They were hungry.
Okay, that it was, that the eating was physical. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, there were 5 loaves, 2 fish.
Okay. So you'd say that's exactly how many? I mean, someone counted those, and so there were, okay, the exact number. Some other ways of concrete.
The point is the miracle.
Yeah. Okay, it's a miracle. Just the way it's said. Right. I think that right. You'd say that it was miraculous how he was able to take that little bit and able feed so many. Okay. So and that's the point that he was able to do that. That did a miracle. Okay. I think again that would be a concrete thinking. And you'd say that's the only reason. Or message, or okay, some other way.
It was a setup.
All right, explain that one too.
Well, it was a setup for the miracle. I mean, the whole thing. You know, this is all we have, you know. So in that sense, it was, the miracle was the point, but we were very well set up for it.
I'm still not quite getting what you mean by that book. Talk about it some more.
Well, you know, it's like a magic trick. You lay the rug and pull it away.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay, so the setup is part of the miracle interpretation,
yeah,
of you.
It was a setup for the divine action.
Okay, good. That this is the primary reason to show the power of Jesus?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. That again would be, I think, a good example of a concrete reading of this. Okay, any other ones?
Can there be more than one concrete interpretation?
Oh yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that would be the point. But see, part of it is seeing that we tend to be, as modern post-industrial thinkers, we tend to be concrete thinkers. What's it going about that? One way it seems to me would be to say that this actually happened, historically this happened. This is historical truth. That would be a concrete interpretation of that.
So say, is there any other way you could interpret it and still call it a concrete example? I mean, concrete means there's only one, right? I mean, so there couldn't be any other ways to give examples of concrete examples.
From your frame of reference, there's no. Yeah.
That's what I mean. But I was just.
But a literal interpretation wouldn't necessarily mean that it's historical. I don't think those necessarily would follow. See, a literal means that you see it happening just the way it's said. There's nothing except what's said. If it's not in the text, it didn't happen. I think that's an understanding of literal. Historical is another question of whether this really did happen. That's, I think, a different interpretation. But that's still a concrete interpretation. You know it's a concrete interpretation when it tends to reduce the meaning of the story to one dimension, I think. Does that make sense to you? That's what I'm saying. It's good to get examples of concrete reading it so that it's not just, it can be one part of it. So it can be literal, it could be historical.
Maybe another concrete reading is saying that he just fed them spiritually, that there was nothing there really to do with the fish and the loaves. So it's not looking at it in a multi-dimensional way, but it's just, you know, reducing it to that one idea. So.
That's an excellent example. See, you go at it another way, you say, well, he wasn't feeding them physically. That the whole purpose of this is spiritual feeding. But notice, what you're doing is either one or the other. You're not saying, right? You're not saying it's both. You're saying that this is a story about physical feeding. And that's what its point is. And then that's the only point that you hold. Yes. Barbara.
Well, similarly, I suppose if you said it's exclusively allegorical, that would be also a concrete reading of saying the five represent the Gentiles, or the two represent this, the 5,000. I mean, you allegorize every single element of the story and say that's what it really is with that?
I think allegory could be a real concrete reading. Again, depending upon how you do it.
A wooden kind of allegory.
What?
If it's a real wooden allegory where you go in.
You can do a kind of psychological allegory.
I think what Mead is talking about is a way of perceiving or thinking. So, in other words, it's good for us just to identify, I think, concrete interpretations so we can recognize them, because we all do them, and we all give them, you know, at various times. So it's a way to, so it can be one or the other. I don't know if that's the point you meant, Scott, but... The psychological is different when you would say it's not just physical. I mean, he fed them both physically and spiritually. Yeah. Then it becomes psychological. See, then it's not just one or the other. The point isn't one. See, one of the ways you can see about concrete interpretations is they tend to reduce so that it becomes a simple identification. But here, psychologically, it seems to me, when you say it would be both spiritual and physical, then you're entering into something else. You're saying that somehow feeding your body physically has also a spiritual dimension, or is also a spiritual, so that you're not, again, separating, but there's something more complex happening. That somehow eating has a social dimension which has a sacredness to it, which is, you know. Yeah, Scott.
I think what I would mean by psychological allegory would be that I understand allegory means something is like something. We take one thing and make a sign out of it, rather than, and it loses its symbolic significance. Now, I think people can do that psychologically, as well as in the literal. I mean, we used to church interpreters would make allegories out of things by saying, "This now refers to the invasion of the Roman," or the rebellion in 70, and or whatever, right? Or the apostasy. And the,
but see, it has something though. In that case, the early Christians came out of the mythological world. Remember, that's how they would have thought. And so that maybe in their allegories, what they really were doing were bringing the reading, if you will, or the text into themselves. So that the allegory probably is more fruitful than we've given it credit for. And what we needed to learn was the process of them using that text, rather than then taking their interpretation and say, well, that's not what it means, you know. That is to say, they were teaching, I think, or working out of a process of owning that text and making it part, and making it relevant to themselves. And we need to do the same thing. I mean, that's the process that's involved here.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I guess that what I'm saying is, sometimes, if the allegory comes down to us as, quote, the interpretation of something, then it's problematic. But if it's a way of understanding it, then it seems to me it's looser. Is that?
Yeah, except that if allegory always feels to me like, as I said, this means this.
Yeah.
As opposed to having a much more open-ended.
Yes. Level. Yes.
Which would be non-allegorical.
Yeah.
It could mean a lot of different things.
Yeah. I think allegory tends to get concretized.
It gets concretized.
Yeah, right. I think there's a tendency there. But I think allegory, well used, is more open, more metaphorical, if you will.
Yeah. One thing I was going to say earlier that occurred to me, and Sarah will really said this, but I hadn't seen this before, is that in the concrete interpretation, doesn't the interpretation usually focus on what Jesus did?
Miracle.
Well, there would be a tendency to look at it in terms of facts, events, okay?
As opposed to, say, the next category, where we will get into what was happening with the people between them. Or
Well, I mean, I think one of the ways, I think, say, a lot of biblical scholarship and the commentaries have tended to really stress the historical, and they've almost then reduced the text to that dimension. And the reason for that, of course, was that if it had historically happened, then we would know it's true. So we somehow identified if it's historical, then it's true, although actually that doesn't really fit when you think about it. Because truth has to do with meaning, and not just to say yes or no, it happened. So, yes.
Mm-hmm. I just have a question about the relationship between these ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm wondering whether they are related in terms of expanding categories that includes the previous category, or whether they relate all, you know, exclusively or both?
The way Michael Mead uses it, they don't include one another. I think what he would say is that, say, babies start out as concrete thinkers, and then they really do, they're able then to use imagination, and in that process they're able to move to another level. And then, of course, we're just kind of realizing how mythologically our world really is constructed. And so a lot of it is that the myths do exist, but we have not been aware of them because we have tended, again, to be much more control-oriented in our society. And the concrete way of perceiving is the easiest way to have control. It's the easiest way to manipulate. If you can name things, identify them, and keep people in that category, you're able to control them.
So his structure is concrete, as it were.
You want to talk more about that?
Well, it sounds, I mean, if they're exclusive, then something is one or the other or the other.
I'm not sure that follows. I mean, I think he's just trying to say again how we perceive that. He's trying to identify. I mean,
I don't think that's bad.
I mean, what I would say in relation to you, I think he's just trying to open up. There might be more ways of thinking, but these three at least are easy enough to talk about. That, for instance, I would say, let me ask you, what are some psychological ways then of interpreting that text? We kind of agree, kind of have an idea of that. What?
Well, you said feeding spiritually and physically.
Okay, so it involves both the physical and spiritual. Okay. So that they aren't exclusive, okay? They're inclusive rather than, I mean, that's a feature here, mm-hmm. so that it's and rather than mm-hmm. or, okay? See, here it's one or the other, all right? What are some other psychological interpretations?
Jesus sets an example that others get caught up in.
Okay, so you look at it in terms of not just Jesus. See, was it Scott, you said, you look at what Jesus did. And he's the only one who's important in the text, all right? So it's his action and so on. But here you would look at Jesus and those he would feed. And those, say, Jesus and the crowds. And then the crowds become an important piece of this. So that it doesn't just focus on one. Mm-hmm. So that they become important in this. Focus. Well, and that makes it more complex then, when you don't just look at it. Yes.
Well, Jesus and the disciples, seems to me there was a conflict.
Okay. Now, in the psychological reading, of course, that would be another psychological reading if you looked at Jesus and the disciples.
Okay.
I picked out the crowd because this one is more considered right now. The crowds haven't been as important, I think. But that would be, again, you'd have at least two. What you need for psychological thinking is at least two things. I mean, that's what you really need. And, opens up. There's a little bit more movement there, you know. Okay? Yes?
So with that common interpretation that got tossed around a whole lot, that what actually happened here was the miracle was that Jesus set the example, and then everybody else pulled out the food that they had been hiding but were too greedy to share because they didn't think everybody else had brought it. I mean, is that a psychological interpretation?
You know, in working with this, you have to be careful that you don't psychologize the text. That would be another way of doing it. So that, say, as a biblical exegete, I say, well, what in the text would really give you any clue that sharing is what this is about? See, I have a little bit of a tendency to think that the sharing is a way to explain away the miracle. Mm-hmm. So now instead of a miracle, what you've done is you've put in that place a natural phenomenon that is pretty miraculous, you could say, if you get people to share. But I'm a little leery of that because I think, again, it's reductionist to say this is a story about sharing.
So then is that explanation a concrete one or a psychological one?
I think that, well, it depends again how it's handled. I think it could be a concrete one. Uh-huh. It would be one that, say, my college students would say, well, that's a nice explanation for this, and then I don't have to believe anything miraculous happened. And it makes a lot more sense of sharing. See, that's what makes me a little suspicious of this as psychologically. It just replaces, again, a way to somehow tie this story up and sew it up and understand it. You know, oh, now I understand it. That's the, you know, and that makes good sense, and that it doesn't really threaten me in any way, and, you know, it's reasonable. That's what I'm getting at, though. is that those readings that somehow fit our mindset and that give, like I have a student who just did a paper last quarter on explaining, and he got this actually from a Jewish scholar, explaining the Exodus, and the crossing of the Red Sea. And you maybe heard this too. And oh no, it wasn't crossing the Red Sea, but it's similar to this, where it was explaining how Jesus walked on water. That was it. And did it by way of sandbars. That actually it looked like Jesus was walking on water, but there were, and now this is actually a biblical scholar who is,
Is that what Peter told me?
So there were sandbars, and then, in any kind of waterway, you can find where sandbars go, And so somehow or other, Jesus walked on the water. Now that would be a concrete reading, and of course, it's inviting. Because it's one answer, it seems clear, you can talk about it, it sounds rather intelligent, there are such things as sandbar, and it looked like Jesus was walking on water, but he's really walking on a sandbar. But you know right away, that as soon as you do that, it just throws, that whole thing just dissolves. The story has no meaning in a way. So we have a tendency for that. Some other psychological readings here.
The leftovers, would that be like Jesus gives us more than we?
I think the leftovers are, that's a nice element there where it's unclear what that's about, isn't it? I think that's nice. See, again, what it does is it pulls out, so he fed the crowds and there were leftovers. Mm-hmm. So now you have two things to think about. I think that is nice. I think that's a nice, yes.
I have a commentary in a footnote in this one that says the denarius was a day's wage for a man, and they specifically say how much money they would have taken to buy food, 200. In other words, you can think that what Jesus was giving them was a very expensive gift, something of value.
Mm-hmm. Another way, I forget which interpretation of that is, because 200 denarii doesn't make very much sense to us. But it would probably be a year's salary. It would be what one person would make in a whole year. So, of course, the disciples are just, think how much money you make. And just say, comparable today, say $20,000. That's what they were saying. So that would be another kind of way of going at that is their astoundedness when they say, God, that's just a whole lot of money we need to feed all these people. I don't think actually that comment is a kind of historical accurate comment of what the disciples said. I think it's a literary, if you will, reaction of the disciples on how much it would cost. It's really interesting because it's hard to believe that that's how much it would cost. I don't know, maybe that is how much it costs to feed 5,000 people in that day. Scholars today have really, it's really interesting, the work that they're doing and trying to analyze, say, how much food people in the first century did take per day. So they'll come along with those calculations. So I could probably find out, I know someone who's doing that research, how much food it would have taken. But of course, even as we talk about that, they have to eat then the next day, and the next day, and the next day. So you'd say, if you look at this in a concrete way, what really did Jesus give them if what he did is feed them once? What kind of a miracle is it? Because, in fact, they're going to need food the next day and the day after that, and on and on and on. So that some or other, it seems to me, this miracle has to be saying a lot more than just that. That somehow or other something else has to be happening in that process. So that the physical feeding has to play out into something more long-lasting for the miracle to have any kind of weight, any kind of importance, any kind of value. I think that's pretty reasonable, wouldn't you say? Some other, anyone want to venture out another psychological reading where you'd have at least two things that you'd be looking at in order to understand and interpret this feeding. Yes?
Well, it's a miracle story, but it has Eucharistic undertones.
Okay, that would be very good. So that, again, you could say it was, feeding in the desert, but that it prefigured the Eucharist. That's good. That's good. So that you're in two dimensions then. Jesus feeding now, but also an ongoing. And that gets us kind of out of that concrete way of feeding them once. Then already you're moving into something here. That's good. Any other? That's good. Okay, how about mythological? Now, mythological really means that it begins, it's I, you take it into yourself. Take it into yourself. Take the whole story into yourself and understand it from within. It's also an action. It's not a noun, but it's an action. It's a movement. So in what way is this story an action or a movement? This is the hardest level to read. It's worse. We're not used to doing this. Yes?
Well, you know, it kind of seems like trying to get the past, the present, and the future all worked in there together.
Right. But not this way, this way. Right.
Okay. One way of looking at it to me would be that God sees my wants and my needs, meets them more than abundantly, and with leftovers, that his abundance, you know, that more than sufficient for all my wants and needs, and that he saw the need of the people, and he met it with grace, tremendous grace. And so to internalize that would be that God is aware. The people did not come to him and grumble and say they were hungry. He saw the people were hungry. And they got to see their wants and needs. I mean, that's past, present, future, always to me. I'm not sure how you word it to make it come out as a mythological statement of this kind of a miracle.
Okay.
The relationship.
That's good. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, another way we were talking about past, present, and future was historical event of the Exodus, you know, feeding in the wilderness, or the Elijah feeding, the present meeting of needs, and then the eschatological banquet type of. Would that be
so
a mythological way of doing it?
Certainly it's more complex when you begin to put that together. I think that if you keep it on a historical spectrum, then it tends not to work so well. But if you can move it so that all is on one level, if you will, then it's going to get more mythological.
Well, can you help us with that one then?
I have an example I'm going to give you, but I want you to get thinking about this, because it's... So, and of course, you can help me.
I may be way out on this, but if you read the story right before it, it's of Herod's birthday and bringing the head of John the Baptist, and it's sort of like a feeding there too, and it's almost that Jesus is working and feeding people kind of eternal life, and here's Herod sort of taking life, and he's sort of, you know, it's sort of like, it's kind of hard. I always, when I read the Bible, it's always hard to read one part and not relate it to another anyway when they fall in that sort of order.
But it's
mythologically, it would make more sense for people to think about, well, comparing that back to one story, back to Herod, you know.
I think it is useful to, as you look at any one story, to be able to move backward and forward so that story becomes more complex and picks up images both before and after. I think that's really valuable for, again, increasingly opening up the story. See, that's what I see is happening here, is when you start with one, you may get an easy, quick answer, or, you know, something that makes people feel sure of meaning so they can hold on to it. But what we really need to do is open up that story so that it can really touch people's lives. And to do that, it seems to me, that's already the,
Oh, I was just going to say, if my three-year-old was telling me this story, the first thing she'd do is exaggerate all the numbers, you know, to try to create the sense of wonder that she's trying to get across in terms of, you know, who and just what Jesus is. And to my way of understanding the story, forget about the factual part of the numbers, and consider the possibility that what's happening here is the disciples don't have any faith that what Jesus has is going to be enough for everyone, but yet the truth is Jesus has plenty for everybody. You know.
Now, one of the, as you're talking, one of the really potent symbols in the story is the bread. And then if you follow up the Gospel of Mark, you find the story where they're in the boat and they say to Jesus, well, he starts talking to them about the bread, and they say, oh, we forgot the bread. Remember that passage in
chapter 8?
Yeah, it's actually in between these.
It's like 8:16 and stuff. We have no bread in verse 16.
Yeah, well, the second feeding is at the beginning of chapter 8, and then it says with 11, the Pharisees came forward and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. He sighed from the depth of his spirit and said, why does this generation seek a sign? Amen, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation. Then he left them, got into the boat again, and went off to the other side. They had forgotten, now meaning the disciples. Now, but Mark's always doing this, you know, where he kind of says they, and you don't know who he means. You think he means the Pharisees here, but he means the disciples. They had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. Now, what you see here is really the beginning with bread as a concrete five loaves here, and just kind of moving down within the text itself into a deeper meaning of bread all along. So that, again, if we allow ourselves to kind of read into the text, and then I think the whole gospel becomes really valuable to probe the real depths of those symbols. So you see what I'm saying? You start with the five loaves. That seems very concrete, a kind of straightforward story here. And then as the gospel unfolds, it gets more and more murky, if you will. They're talking about, so he says, one loaf. He says to them, watch out, guard against the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. So now leaven becomes part of it. So it grows more mysterious, it seems to me. And the reason, of course, is so that story kind of sinks into your soul. That you begin to let that narrative, not talking again about what happened then, but how, in fact, that can address what's happening within you. So you take that whole story within yourself. So now it's not, say, Jesus out there that you're dealing with, but you're dealing with your own stuff that all of this touches. So there is within you, if you will, a Herod that betrays or beheads prophets. There is within you a Jesus that feeds. There is within you a crowd with need. There is. In other words, what it's picking up is that kind of mythic lower stuff within us that moves us in our lives. I might give this definition is from Sam Keen. You know Sam Keen? He's a series of books. He has one I really like called Beginnings Without End. But anyway, he says, journalists often use the word myth to mean at best a silly tale and at worst a cynical untruth, a lie. Theologians and propagandists often brand as myths religious beliefs and ideologies other than their own. So they have the truth and everyone else has myths. And in a way, they're closer to the real meaning than journalists are. In a strict sense, myth refers to interlocking stories, rituals, rites, customs, and beliefs that give a pitiful, pivotal, not pitiful. That was not a Freudian slip, I guess. In a pivotal sense of meaning and direction to a person, a family, a community, or a culture. So the myths, we have myths that operate in our lives. Each one of us have myths that we operate off of. The communities that we belong to have myths. The Christian churches have myths. So they're both outside and they're also within us. And we have internalized those, is what he's saying. The dominant myth that informs a person or a culture is like the information contained in the DNA of a cell, or the program in the system's disk of a computer. Myth is the cultural DNA, the software, the unconscious information, the program that governs the way we see reality and behave. You can see the importance then of really spending time understanding the mythic patterns that you live off of, and that our faith communities live off of, and that our country lives off of. Because some of those are dangerous. And certainly part of the teaching of Jesus was to break myths. In fact, parable is probably precisely that. It reverses a myth, or it subverts a myth, you could say. So the parables really get at the mythic stuff within Jesus' own culture. Some more on this, and then I'd like to share with you an example. Yes?
You spoke of having an eye in it and having an action
yes.
in it. And my second reading of it tonight didn't lead me to loaves or to any kind of Eucharistic visions, but the few verses before it talk about how busy they were, how overwhelmed with all the people and the comings and goings and no time to eat, mm-hmm. and how they tried to get away, tried to retreat for themselves. And when the disciples basically just freaked out about how we're going to serve more, and Jesus said, how many loaves have you? Go and see. To me, that said, draw deeper within you, Mary. And that spoke in a way that said I or me and said action, you know, look again. And how it didn't come from the symbolic loaf of Christ. Well, I guess it did in a sense if I figure that I ate from that too, but it said go inside and give more and you'll find more.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an excellent reading. Mm-hmm. An excellent reading of it. Because certainly that would also answer that problem of what Jesus was doing in this feeding. It certainly had something to do with empowering people who had needs but had no sense that they could answer their own needs. Because what he's breaking then is the myth of being helpless. And your reading of that is precisely what's happening there. Yes?
I just wonder if the person... Is it like in the scientific world where you like you report what happens in that? Without faith, if you can't really make that kind of interpretation that she just made. I mean, somewhere in life you have to start with the if somebody's actually powerful enough to make that kind of miracle happen, and then you say, well, maybe if there's that much power, then I can. And you try something and it works a few times, and then you get to a place where the miracle is something that you've experienced yourself, and then you can say, well, now maybe there's some other interpretations that are available for that. But if you really never get to the place where you agree that person could have done something that powerful, you maybe never get to the place where you can make an additional interpretation of it, because you figure, well, you know, it's just another story that I'll prove false if I do a scientific study of it, it's not going to come out right. I'm going to have, somebody's going to, you know, come up with something and says it really didn't happen. So that I don't have to take it seriously in terms of making an adaptation of my own lifestyle.
Right. Or, I mean, I think that's one of the things that happened like, with my students. They may throw this whole thing out. I mean, they'll just, it doesn't make sense on this level. So then they're not able to use it on any of these other levels either. Mm-hmm. I mean, what happens is it becomes for them, quote, a myth in the bad sense, because they don't think it's true. But actually, that's just the beginning. I mean, which is what you're saying there, it seems to me. That it's entering in on this level and then moving down, which comes to the real value of it, yes.
That's what, I think that's where that question was coming from, about, you know, how they're related, because it seems
I see what you mean, yeah.
That, you know, the historical questions, precisely what you said, you know, if one decides that everything isn't grounded in history, mm-hmm. you know, and truth is
yes.
history, and then to throw that out.
Yes. And I'm not, I wouldn't necessarily say that you give up on the history of it. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that if you say that this can only be interpreted as a historical event in Jesus' life that really took place and so on, then it seems to me that you're reducing it to one understanding. And that's where I think the problem comes in. But those questions, again, I think are really valuable for students to move down into the text. I think that's good. I saw some other hands. Yes.
It seems to me that in some ways this third category just has to stay blank up there, because at any attempt for us to share it with each other puts it into words, verbalizes it, intellectualizes it, and the extent to which we do that then takes it out of that level and puts it back to the other level. And that no matter
yes.
how much we can all agree of Mary's wonderful reading of that, mm-hmm. even that is a construct that we all still have experienced, even her reading individually. And when we think we are agreeing on something in words, it still is understood non-verbally.
Yes, yes.
Well, that's why you have I up there, because, you know, I is the most profound thing you can say about mythology. And I would hope that every single I in this room would have their own mythological understanding of this. Yeah.
Because it draws upon a person's experience. And I also think it means we have to face that not every story then we have within the Jesus tradition is going to be of equal value and importance to Christians. That some of those stories are really going to, or at different times of your life, some of them, that the importance again is that students know or people know those stories and can draw upon those for their life at various times. Again, I think we tended to learn the stories if they were all important to us, you know, all the time.
Yeah.
And not realize that, no, as a matter of fact, there's a rhythm to this and there's a give and take. And
I have a long-standing argument with editors, with you know, dailies. Dailies no longer simply report anything; they mostly editorialize on what they report. They insist that I understand everything how they understand
right.
it. You know? But then I remember, you know, I've pastored 5 congregations over 38 years, and as I look back, I probably did a whole lot less simply telling the story without editorializing the story.
That's excellent. That's excellent.
Okay. I didn't give the story its own opportunity to
that's right.
be. Yeah.
So what teachers and pastors need to do is really make that story as vivid and as available to persons.
Yeah.
I think that's really true. I'm going to switch just a little bit here, and because So she gave us a reading of that, and I'm sure you, as you noticed, you can have different readings of that. But also there can be a community reading of that on this level, on the mythological level. An example, I think, that I've seen that's just excellent, I actually brought this along, but we don't have a video player here, and so I'll see, maybe we can...
We do.
Right
here.
Okay. let me go get... What time is it? Is it too late?
Yeah.
this is, it isn't too long. Maybe I can tell you about it. And but we can see it at another time. It's a movie, Places of the Heart. You've ever seen that movie?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, just to kind of refresh your memory, it begins, at the beginning, there's this wonderful song, and you probably know the song. I wish I could just get it. It'll just take me a minute to get it. To see the beginning of it and hear the song, it's a song that's so wonderful. And
it's Blessed Assurance.
Can you sing that? Do you know that?
Jesus is mine. What a born days of glory divine.
That's
wonderful. For his spirit washing his blood. This is my story.
It's my story.
My song. Praising my Savior all the day long.
That is the finest use of a mythological interpretation of the Eucharist I've ever seen. Because that's the story starts out, it's in the 30s, and it's a congregation, and they're singing that song. And, of course, they're all worshiping in this church. And it's a segregated, I mean, it's in the 30s, so there's segregation. And what happens at the beginning of the story, they show you those people worshiping and singing that song. Then they show you white families at their table. Then they show you black families, and they're eating together. So that the eating of the Eucharist in the church is separated from the eating outside. So you see not one Christian community, but you see the black Christian community and the white Christian community. So you would say there's something wrong with the myth, isn't there? When the Eucharist is supposed to be Christians praying together, but in real life, that's not what happens. And then what follows, if you remember, is it's the white, I mean, it's just wonderful. The whole thing is uneating. I mean, that's where all the myth comes back to. So it shows you the sheriff, and Sally Fields is his wife, and the two children, boy and girl, you know, at the table. And the sheriff is called up. She's just ready to serve dinner, and they have it on their plates, and then he's called out. And he goes out, and there's a black youth who has been drinking and shooting. Is a gun, and so they call the sheriff to get the gun away and so on, okay? So he comes down and he talks to the black youth. And the black youth, of course, is just, not functioning, you know, he's throwing up bottles and shooting at them. And he does this, and the sheriff is saying, come on, you know, he knows him and so on. And then he turns to the sheriff and he thinks he has no more bullets left. And he shoots mockingly, you know, kind of shoots the sheriff, and has a bullet in it, and he kills the sheriff. And what happens, of course, is that the reaction of that is for a number of people in town to get the black man. And they drag his body past the house of the sheriff's wife's house, as if justice now has been done. And what follows then is a story of racism. It's just rather interesting. And what happens is that it's a black man who comes to her cotton farm, and she's going to lose the farm. And of course, she's going to lose it to the white bankers, of course, who really push her to sell. And she digs in, and this black man comes and helps her grow cotton, so she saves the farm. But she also was able to get the first crop of cotton in. Of course, that meant she got this $100 or whatever. And there's such resentment because she was successful and the black man helped her that the Ku Klux Klan comes in and they give him a warning, actually, and so on. And there's more to it, obviously. But what's wonderful is at the end of this, after that whole rather unsightly story is told in many ways. And it's our story, say, as Americans, that's our story. That's our history. What's interesting is that at the end, they show the whole community in church again, singing that same song. And there is a sheriff singing, and there is the black boy who shot him, and there is the wife and the black man who helped her. Now that's a mythological interpretation of Eucharist. The meaning of Eucharist is precisely about betrayal and forgiveness. It means that no meal that a Christian eats should be far from that mystery of how we betray, how we need forgiveness, how we need to give forgiveness. That's at the very heart of what it means to be a Christian. But that level, it seems to me, we've never gotten down to. Somehow or other, we have, in our churches even, used Eucharist as a divine. They tell a wonderful story, Roman Catholic story. Again, I can do that because it's my tradition, right? During the Vatican Council in the 60s, 62 to 65, some years ago now, 25 years ago, there were a group of bishops who had met. And one of the bishops was telling how at one of the services, a number of the Protestant observers at the council came forward. And he knew they were Protestant. Now, this is back in 1960. The Catholic Church is pretty strict about who can receive communion within its, you know. And so remember, I mean, even if you were divorced, you can receive communion in the Catholic Church. And, you know, certainly, if you, I mean, not. You know, they had all kinds of regulations for all of this. Joseph knows, confirming him. Anyway, so the bishop is telling this story to his fellow bishops about there he was handing out communion. And he saw these Protestants. And so he was saying to his brother bishops, he said, and, you know, I thought, I didn't know what to do. And then I thought, well, what would Jesus do? And the other bishop said, oh, you didn't.
Isn't that telling them?
Can I share with you? I retired, with vacation time coming, we left Vancouver in the middle of September, and we're boaters, and we went to up in Desolation Sound in Canada, and on this particular Sunday we were going to worship in Campbell River. On Saturday I called the local priest, Father Paris, and I asked Father, do you share the Eucharist with an old retired Lutheran pastor and his wife? And he said, well, I wonder what my bishop would say. And I responded to him, well, you know, Father, we do know what Jesus said, but it's true that we don't always know what our bishops are going to say. He just bursted out laughing. He said, well, it's so clear you want to share the liturgy. Please come. Yeah.